to welcome the stranger. Scripture tells us to love our neighbor as ourselves. Who is your neighbor? My sixth grade teacher, Betty Nelson, would ask us, and then she would answer, lest we gave the wrong answer, she would answer, your neighbor is every man, woman, and child. She made no distinctions. Everyone. Every man, woman, and child. It's funny how some things like that will stick with you for a lifetime. I love stories, both hearing them and telling them, so I want to tell you a couple of stories this morning. We'll begin with a story that's one of the short chapters from my book about a cross-country bicycle ride that I took 9 years ago now with a couple of friends. We rode for 47 days from Carlsbad, California to Bowers Beach, Delaware. Excellent experience. So this particular event begins. We began our 16th day in Springer, New Mexico, setting out early because the weather was supposed to start out ugly and then get worse as the day wore on. We rode out along Maxwell Avenue, heading up toward the highway on the edge of town. Even at the beginning, we rode through a pea soup fog punctuated by driving rain. And as we rode past the electronic marquee in front of the Farmers and Cattlemen's International Bank, and honest to God, that was the name of it, it said that it was 42 degrees at 6:30 a.m. Oh my God, I said a quiet prayer to myself. The weather forecast did not let us down. Things got, well, they did not get any better. The challenges were many. It was cold and rainy. I was soaked to the bone and freezing. My eyeglasses were dripping wet inside and out, and they got all fogged up so that I had to take them off, which is not a particularly good thing for me to do with my glasses. And to top it off, there was a strong headwind that put my writing progress into very slow motion. You might have had dreams like that. I certainly have. So we three writers were all fairly miserable. And so each of us kind of went at our own fastest pace, trying to get somewhere, anywhere, so that we could get out of that weather. Towns are infrequent in northern New Mexico. 35 miles up the road, what seemed like an eternity, we arrived one by one at the almost non-existent town of Gladstone. I got there about an hour and a half after the first writer, Bill, and about a half an hour after the second writer, Chris. I can't really exaggerate about how much slower I am in comparison to the two of them. They were already well on their way to being warm and dry when I walked into the Gladstone Mercantile Exchange, which was run by a kindly woman named Thelma. When Bob Dylan wrote the line, "Come in," she said, "and I'll give you shelter from the storm," I think it was Thelma at the Gladstone Mercantile Exchange he had in mind. She had plenty of hot coffee in a pot on the wood stove, and we were welcome to it. She did not mind that we were walking around in soggy, stocking feet, leaving wet footprints everywhere. She didn't even mind that we had strewn our wet clothes all over the store so that they might dry out a little. She exuded a do what you need to do and don't worry about it kind of attitude, and so we did. I was sore and wet and cold and grouchy and hungry. After a few minutes, I walked over to where Thelma was sitting, and I asked if I could get a couple of eggs over easy and some whole wheat toast. "Sure," she said, "but you should know that even though we call it whole wheat, we don't really have whole wheat." "Is that okay?" I nodded. "You want some jelly with that?" "Do you have strawberry?" I asked. "No," she said, "but I do have some really good homemade choke cherry jelly that I think you might like." "Yeah," I said, "that sounds great." My meal was perfectly fine and certainly hit the spot. A little later, when we'd finally thawed out and dried up as much as we were going to, and it was time to start writing again, I asked Thelma what I owed her for breakfast. "Well," she said, "we don't really serve breakfast here. But I could see that you needed it. Do you think $2.50 would be all right?" We were warm not only by the wood stove at Thelma's Gladstone Mercantile Exchange, but also by the warmth of her gracious hospitality and generous care. I don't know how many times we said thank you as we left. It was quite a few. And when we got back outside, we looked up to the sky to see if there was any clearing in the weather, and it looked just exactly as it had when we first stopped at Thelma's. Foggy, drizzling, windy, and cold. The sky and the horizon were indistinguishable through the rain, and it was still so foggy that you couldn't see the fence posts along the side of the road. You could hear the birds on the fence wire, but you couldn't see them. It may not have been any colder, but it wasn't any warmer either. Oh well. The thing was, though, that now I was warm. I didn't feel cold again that whole day. Talk about a breakfast that sticks to your ribs. I've always depended on the kindness of strangers, said Blanche DuBois in A Streetcar Named Desire. She's not alone in that regard. But I suppose that was Tennessee Williams' point in the first place. She wasn't alone. She depended on others. None of us are in this alone. We all depend on the kindness of strangers. And in turn, we have our moment in time of being the stranger, or when it's our turn for doing the giving. All my life's a circle, Harry Chapin used to sing. I imagine that means we should take every opportunity, as Thelma did that day, to care for strangers ourselves. It's all going around and coming around. Today you're at home, and tomorrow maybe it's you who is on the road. The thing is, there I was, a stranger, and there Thelma was, a minister. She was ministering to a bunch of soggy, somewhat beyond middle-aged vagabond travelers who were passing through. She welcomed us and she served us, and that was her ministry. Story number two. A Guatemalan woman named Susana, along with her infant son Miguel, began working her way north through Central America sometime early just this past spring. Susana is a survivor of both domestic and gang violence, and yes, of the very worst sort. She had received threats of further violence and even death on hers and her baby's lives. With no protection from local authorities, Guatemala was no longer a place that was compatible with life. Imagine that for a moment. What might you do in her situation? What might anyone do? Perhaps America would be a place where they could find safety and asylum, a place where they might start a new life. It was at least a hope where precious little hope existed. Carrying her son in a baby sling, Johanna set out on her way. She was going to work her way north, stopping in towns in order to work a day or a few days here and there, and then continue the trek. But then somewhere in southern Mexico, she just by chance, happened to hear about a caravan of other asylum seekers, and she decided to throw her lot in with theirs. For several weeks they traveled, sometimes in vehicles, sometimes on foot, sleeping in makeshift camps and in parks in towns and along the roadside. Donations had been made to sustain the compas, the friends, on the caravan. There was enough food for everyone, even formula for Johanna's and others' babies. So I have tried to change the name because we're recording this, and I'm not going to try to do that anymore, and there will be no last names given. It was not easy travel, not by any stretch of the imagination. Eventually, they arrived in Tijuana, and then on April the 24th, they began to surrender themselves to the U.S. ICE agents, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents at the border in San Diego. Johanna and Angel were on the very first busload to go through that checkpoint, and they were taken into custody together. The administration's policy of separating parents from children didn't begin until the following day. Perhaps their fortunes had already begun to change. Perhaps it was a miracle. They were held in detention for a few days in San Diego and then flown to a more family-oriented facility in Dilley, Texas, and there they remained for the next month. Earlier in April, my wife Judy and I received an email. The UUSC, the service committee, was working with Surge, standing up for racial justice, and they were looking for potential sponsors for the compas who had traveled in the caravan. The email asked if we might be willing to be sponsors. We talked about it for a couple of minutes, but really we didn't even need that much time. Yes, we would, we said. But still, neither of us truly believed that it would come to fruition. A couple of weeks later, we received a phone call from a Surge volunteer. "So, are you still willing?" she asked. "Yes, we are." "For a family or for an individual or for maybe a mother and a child?" "For an individual or a mother and child," we thought. "And for how long do you think you would be able to host them?" And naively, we answered, "Oh, for a few weeks, maybe even a couple of months if it's necessary." "Okay," the woman said, "we'll let you know if we're able to match you up." So we started to think that maybe this thing was going to come to pass, but we still didn't fully expect that it was absolutely going to. We wrote a letter to ICE applying for sponsorship status and had a host of other people write supporting letters on our behalf. And by now, we were part of an email group with others who had volunteered. We learned through these chats that a couple of months would likely only be the beginning of a much, much longer stay by the refugees in their sponsors' homes. We watched as other potential sponsors were connected with their compas. So we asked the coordinator from Surge if she thought we would get a match. "Oh, you're already matched," she said. "I'm sorry, I thought I'd told you." "That still doesn't mean it will happen," she added. "That will depend on ICE." So we were given, at that time, Johanna and Angel's names. People. Real people. Real refugees. Real neighbors. In need of welcome and safety and healing and love. The next major hurdle was that Johanna would have to pass her credible fear interview with ICE agents. Try to imagine that one. Having been brutalized, threatened with her life, traveling 4,000 miles with a baby, and then being asked to prove that your fears have credibility, she was and she did. 2 or 3 more weeks passed. We had 2 phone conversations with Johanna. The first one between Judy and Johanna was facilitated by a volunteer translator. I wasn't home, but Judy assured me upon my arrival that it had been a great conversation and that she had a really good feeling about this woman that she talked with. The second call wasn't quite so well facilitated language-wise, but we were able to express our feelings of anticipation and hope with one another and just a bit of our apprehension. Finally, one day, I was bicycle riding near Rehoboth, Massachusetts with a rabbi friend of mine. Funny how bicycles often turn up in my stories. My cell phone rang. "I better take this," I said to Alan. And sure enough, it was an ICE agent. "Is this Charles Ortman?" "It is." "What is your wife's name?" "It's Judy Ortman." "And do you live at?" And he listed our address. "Yes. Yes, we do." "And are you, in fact, willing to sponsor these potential refugees, Johanna and Angel?" "Yes, we are," I answered. And that was pretty much the extent of the vetting of Judy and me that was pursued by our government officials. I was then told that I'd receive another call within 2 or 3 days instructing me on how to secure airline tickets in order to fly Johanna and Angel to Rhode Island. We didn't actually get a phone call, though. Instead, a few days later, I received a text message written threateningly in Spanish. My Spanish was good enough to discern that our actions were critical to Johanna's release, but not good enough to comprehend the exact steps that we had to take in order for that to occur. Later that afternoon, we were able to connect with an English-speaking ICE agent by telephone, and the process was made clear. Johanna and Angel arrived at TF Green Airport a few days later. Very, very late the night of Memorial Day. They have been with us since then, and unless the administration has its way prior to then, they will likely be with us for at least the next year or two before they are able to establish an independent life of their own. Oddly enough, our government assures their dependency by denying any sort of a work permit that might allow for independence. The system is not structure to promote a successful outcome. With a fourth grade education, Johanna is one of the smartest people that I know. She is strong and resilient, tough as nails. She is gracious and generous, thoughtful and grateful, and she's really a good cook, which is not a bad trait to bring with you. Angel is about as pleasant a baby as I have ever known, and I have known lots of babies. I'm one of 10 children in my family, and so gazillions of babies always, and he is possibly the most pleasant baby I have ever known. Sure, he fusses sometimes. As he grows, he gets into more things that we are always challenged in keeping up with, but he's a breath of fresh air, and he brightens any room he enters. Our first encounter each morning of each day is like the gift of a rainbow, even when it has not been raining. I'll tell you a very quick side story. Shortly after their arrival, I was invited to a signing of the Dreamers Driver's License Act at the Rhode Island State House, and took Angel and Johanna along with, and Angel was sitting on my lap through most of the ceremony, enticing everyone around him, and afterwards we were invited to come up and talk with the governor, who picked the baby up, and both of them had this incredible smile on their face that was captured and was on the front page of the Providence Journal the next morning. He brightens up everything. Johanna is a loving and devoted mother. We work hard with her so that one day she will have her own home. The biggest challenge that we have is language. Although she takes ESL classes, she arrives speaking no English at all. Judy speaks next to no Spanish, and that makes me the most bilingual of the lot, and that's something of a pathetic situation. It does give us cause for laughter, though, and we do enjoy plenty of that. On hearing our story, many people respond that they think Judy and I are doing something that almost borders on saintly by having invited Johanna and Angel into our home and into our lives. My response generally is that there was a need. We were able to meet that need. And since we could, how could we not? It's not saintly to do what you're called to do. It's merely welcoming an opportunity, the possibility that might help you to grow your soul. And that's what we're all here to do, right? To grow our souls. I have to share a pet peeve of mine. I'm not sure where this began or even when, but there is a message that our culture has taken on as a mantra and that we impose upon our children, and I think it's an enormous mistake. It's the message that our children should never trust a stranger. Don't ever speak to a stranger, our children are told. Besides teaching our children that we should always fear whom and what we do not know, this message defies the universal religious principle that we are constantly saved by strangers. I'm not saying that we or our children should ignorantly put ourselves in harm's way. I am suggesting that we all need to learn how to encounter the stranger with integrity, with goodwill, and in good faith. Who is our neighbor? Every man, woman, and child. Here is what I would want you to know. Johanna and Angel have been an incredible blessing in our lives. In this current climate of celebrated narcissism and bullying, of self-serving interests and fear-mongering racism, Johanna and Angel offer Judy and me a way of resisting all that hate. In these troubled times, that is an incredible gift, to have something you can do in response. I don't know how often I hear people say, gosh, I wish there was something I could do to counter all of the horrible things that are happening in this country and around the world, things that are happening in our names. I have to think that there is something for all of us to do if we pay attention. And I have to think that whatever it might be, it very likely has something to do with loving our neighbors as ourselves. It has something to do with being a worthy guest house, welcoming our neighbors and every possibility that comes along that engages us in growing our souls. We take turns at being the minister and being ministered to. I don't know what I might have done for Thelma that morning back in the Mercantile Exchange in Gladstone. But I have to guess that there was something in it that was good for her. There surely was for me. And I can assure you that it's as easy for me to see at home now what good we are doing for Angel and Johanna as it is for me to see what good they're doing for us. It's all such a delicate balance. Both of these stories are loaded with implications of salvation. Saved from what? I don't think that's the right question. Saved for what? Might be the better question. And the answer to that question is, well, I think that's your story to tell. And I wouldn't want to spoil it for you, but I would surely welcome and encourage your consideration of it. What are you called to do during these times? What is it that you need to do so that you can feel that you are a part of something that responds to the fear and the anger and the hatred? A rabbi once asked his student how he would know that the light of dawn had come. And the student answered, "When you can tell the difference between an olive tree and a walnut tree?" And the rabbi responded, that's a very good answer, but no, it's not that. Well, then is it when you can tell the difference between a dog and a goat? No, it's not that, the rabbi said. And then the rabbi explained, "It is when you can look in the face of a stranger and see in that face your brother or sister. See in that face your child or your grandchild. See in that face yourself. That is when you will know that daylight has finally come." Once again, I've always depended on the kindness of strangers, said Blanche DuBois. She was not alone in that regard. And that was Tennessee Williams' point. She wasn't alone. She depended on others. None of us are in this alone. We all depend on the kindness of strangers. We are all, at times, the stranger. This Being Human is a guest house. You want to know how you might respond to the madness that surrounds us in this country and in the world? Pay attention. Your invitation is already in hand, and it is up to you whether to welcome it or not. Be bold, my friends. Be bold. Amen.